Welcome to the Social Science Sampler. I'm Stan Rhodes, and with us today we have Dr. Jorgensen, and we'll just start right in. Dr. Jorgensen, why did you pursue grad school and a PhD, and why did you then become a faculty member?
Boy, those are great questions. I pursued a graduate degree, or I went to grad school and pursued a PhD since when I was an undergrad majoring in sociology. I took a course in what is known as environmental sociology. I didn't know what environmental sociology was, and then I enrolled in this course, and that was the title. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting and different from anything else I've taken. And by about the third week of that course, I realized that I was just fell in love with it, and I thought, my goodness, this is really interesting, and I would love to try to figure out a way of turning this into some kind of a career. And I asked the professor, so what can I do? And he said, well, if you really like this stuff, and you seem to have a knack for it, you should think about going to graduate school. And that's got me thinking about it. And then his name was Tom Burns. He was faculty at the University of Utah, where I was an undergrad a long time ago, and he's now at University of Oklahoma. But he took me under his wing and, you know, showed me the ropes, gave me a lot of things to read, involved me in some research projects, you know, in a very sort of light way, since I was really young and I didn't really have any research skills yet. But he showed me what it means to do social science, showed me what statistical modeling looks like, how you build a data set, how you come up with research questions, how you engage in social theory to derive hypotheses to test, like all of that stuff. And I learned a lot of that just sitting in his office before I actually took courses in methods or statistics. It was kind of the flip-flop way of doing it, where I was exposed to that first before I actually took courses in doing some of those things. And I just fell in love with it. I thought, this is really neat. And apparently you can do this for a career, but you need a graduate degree to do it. And so that's really what I think put me on the path of wanting to pursue a PhD.
Why did you pursue a faculty position?
I mean, honestly, I think the biggest reason is I just thought it would be really lovely to work with students and try to pay it forward, as hokey as that sounds. Working with undergrads and then graduate students. I had an amazing mentor when I was a PhD student, Christopher Chase Dunn, who just was the most generous and supportive human being I've ever met. And I just thought, you know, I'd love to try to pay that forward and work with students the way that I've been treated and mentored. And also, you know, pragmatically, what are you going to do with a PhD in sociology? Unlike a lot of other fields, you don't see a lot of folks with PhDs in sociology working outside of the academy. You see some working in the nonprofit sector and doing policy work and doing consulting or I guess some work in industry. But I wasn't really interested in that stuff. I really like the idea I really enjoy the environment, what it feels like when you're on a university campus.
Okay, and that's a great segue, I think, to the next question, which is, in your work with carbon emissions, people think about that as a very material and industrial sort of thing. And so one of the questions I'd have is, as an environmental sociologist, as someone who's doing interdisciplinary work, how do you bridge and link those two in your work? And what are some lessons that you have from trying to do that you think would be good for people out there just interested in the matter or students getting started?
I think that I tend to approach things from a very macro perspective. Like one of the ways that I'll describe how I view things as a macro sociologist is almost like looking at the natural world and the social world from space through a telescope, and thinking about how things are really interconnected from a very kind of global, telescopic kind of perspective, sort of as a starting point. And so a lot of the research that I did early in my career, going back to even my master's thesis forward, really focused on how the structure of the world economy impacts the environment in different sorts of ways, and how those environmental impacts are distributed unevenly, geographically, and structurally, and institutionally, like around the world. And, you know, a simpler way would be to say I studied how forms of globalization impact the environment using those kinds of, I don't know, more common, less sophisticated sounding words. But it involves actually focusing on a lot of kind of industrial kinds of processes, but from a social science perspective, trying to understand how the organization of production and the organization of trade, how it might have unintended environmental impacts. And so, yeah, I would say for about the first 10 years of my career, that was a primary focus, looking at really how not just levels of trade, but exchange relationships, trade relationships, export-oriented production processes impact the environment. And again, I want to emphasize in ways that are typically unintended, and also to gain a better understanding of how those things impact the environment so we can perhaps change that, you know, to lessen the environmental impacts of those sorts of world economic activities. And also, you know, there's a whole other sort of political side in terms of how, you know, regulatory conditions might sort of shape how industrial processes and economic sorts of activities may or may not impact the environment. So more broadly, it's really taking what we often refer to as a political economic approach to studying how humans impact the environment. But I mean it more broadly than how that's traditionally applied, because I think oftentimes when someone says political economy, that implies a very kind of critical kind of approach to things. And it may or may not be critical. To me, those are, you know, questions. You know, there are theories, there are political economy theories, some that are more critical, some that are less critical. And for me, theory is a tool. Like, I have no particular theory that I'm wedded to. I just, for me, theories are tools, just like research methods are tools, and some theories are useful and some are not, and I'm really a big fan of trying to test theories to see how generalizable they are, how useful they are for explaining these sorts of socio-environmental relationships, and then doing the research to see, well, okay, here are the findings, so we kind of, maybe we need to refine these theories or move on and sort of kick some of these theories to the curb that aren't useful. But I realize that's like sort of just, that's a very traditional way of thinking about doing empirical research that's definitely not like unique to my discipline. I think that's a pretty typical way of doing things, but that's how I tend to approach things.
And so you said that you use theories as tools. I'm wondering if you think that you have sort of more of a problem-based approach. Is that what you would, and then?
Absolutely.
So in the vein of a problem-based approach, what do you think are one of the biggest puzzles or problems that current and future scholars need to look at in your area? And maybe this would include both things that you're planning on pursuing and things that if you could clone yourself, you would also pursue.
Yeah, I think whenever you ask someone a question like that, the first thing that comes to mind is whatever they're really excited about at that given point. So I could tell you right now, oh, the work I'm doing right now is what I think is really important, because it's what I'm really excited about, because it's new and, you know, I'm in the weeds with it. But I think that, I guess I'll do that a little bit, you know.
Please do.
So I think that a lot of the things that I'm interested in and really taking a problems-oriented approach, they're basic or fundamental kinds of sustainability questions, especially if you look at how like the sustainable development goals are organized and interconnected, you know, which I know we oftentimes think about those. And, you know, thinking about, you know, just like these basic ideas, but important ideas of improving human well-being, reducing our environmental impacts, and how those things are interconnected. And a big question for me, or an underlying question for me, and I think it's largely too tied to just being trained as a sociologist. We're a discipline that tends to focus on stratification, forms of inequalities broadly defined. And so I'm really interested in trying to understand how different types of social inequalities might have intended or unintended impacts on the environment, but also how different kinds of inequalities that we study might simultaneously impact human well-being and the environment. And to me, those are really fundamental kinds of sustainability questions. And we can approach those from social science perspectives, from very technical engineering kinds of perspectives, from natural science perspectives. And actually, I think we need to do all of the above to really get a good sort of systematic understanding of what's going on. So I tend to, you know, approach that stuff from a sociological perspective. But yeah, inequality broadly defined, at different scales, I really am motivated by scalable kinds of questions. And what I mean by that is, and I'll get into a lot of these details, I guess, in the talks I'm giving here the next couple of days, but the different units of analyses in which I and my colleagues conduct our research, you know, from the global down to facility level kinds of things and in between. So I'm really motivated by questions that are scalable and how income and wealth, inequality at multiple scales might have environmental impacts directly and indirectly, but also human well-being impacts. And these are really, you know, we're not, I or my colleagues and I, we're not the only people asking these sorts of questions, you know. Other folks are too, in our disciplines and in other disciplines. But, for example, you can look at and think about and study and model how income and wealth inequities in international contexts might be related to the environment, you know, energy consumption, CO2 emissions, something like that. But you could also scale those questions down and ask those same kinds of questions subnationally, like in the U.S., at the U.S. state level, for example. Or you could scale it down to the, if we're focusing on the U.S., the county level, or the neighborhood level, or ideally all the way down to the household level, or the individual level if you have the data, you know, the data to do it, or if you can obtain the appropriate data to do it. Or ideally to do all these things simultaneously, you know, look at these sorts of interrelationships of multiple levels simultaneously.
You're talking about scaling it at different levels and if you have the data. So let's talk about methods for a second. Well, let's talk a little bit about data, but also talk about methods because of course both are important. What do you consider to be the core tools in your methods toolbox and the way that you think about the data that you're pursuing or needing?
So as far as like methods in my toolbox, for me, I am a firm believer in your research questions sort of shaping what your research design and research methods are going to be. And I'm a really big believer in that, and that's how I train my graduate students. That's how I encourage my colleagues to pursue their research. Rather than being a big fan of particular research methods and pursuing research questions that align with my preferred methods. Now, sometimes that can be tricky because you can end up in a situation where you come up with new research questions where you realize that you really ideally should be utilizing particular research designs or methods that you don't know how to use. So you have to go out and learn new things, or you need to find collaborators that have expertise in those methods. And I've experienced both, which has been great, you know, being in a situation where I have to learn new methods on my own in informal ways, or taking, you know, new seminars and new methods, or pursuing collaborative research projects with colleagues in my discipline or in sister disciplines that have different areas of methodological expertise that are really needed and warranted for the projects we're pursuing. A lot of the research questions that I've pursued throughout my career have led me to using different kinds of statistical modeling techniques. I would say well over 90% of the work that I've done has been quantitative in one way or the other. One of the things that has changed gradually throughout my career is going from what we refer to as looking at things cross-sectionally to looking at things longitudinally and in multi-level kinds of contexts. Basically because the data have become available, or I've been able to obtain data that have allowed me to use those more kind of rigorous or sophisticated methods. You know, if you have longitudinal data, you should use it because it allows you to do things that cross-sectional data just simply can't do. And longitudinal methods and multi-level methods are mathematically really similar. I mean, they're almost identical mathematically. And a lot of the questions that I pursue, though, do lead me to using longitudinal methods. I would say that that's probably my most commonly used type of statistical modeling technique. Longitudinal methods, panel models, time series, cross-sectional analyses. I mean, we have all these different labels for them, but I just like to call them longitudinal methods for short. Another technique that I've been using lately in some collaborative work that I think is really interesting, it's kind of a hybrid method. It's called qualitative comparative analysis. And it's really not a quote-unquote qualitative method. It's sort of, I don't know what I'd call it. It's derived, there's a whole lot of Boolean algebra involved in it. And one of the things that's really neat about this method, if not familiar with it, is it allows you to take a lot of data and identify, I mean, you could think of like higher order complex interactions, you know, like, or different combinations of factors that might lead to a similar outcome in a way that's much more flexible than a traditional regression model. Like a lot of things when we're using quantitative methods like regression models, we know that we should be looking at different kinds of interactions and using interactions. But if you do any of that, or if you have any experience using those methods, when you start throwing interactions in your models, things get really messy and really complicated really quickly. And there's just But there's a lot of rigidity to it, too, in terms of what you can and can't do with looking at higher-order interactions in a regression model context. And so qualitative comparative analysis allows you to really look at different configurations of factors in a way that is more flexible than regression analyses. There's this notion of equifinality in qualitative comparative analysis that's really cool. So imagine you go to a friend's house. You're like, hey, I just baked a loaf of bread. You should try it. And you eat a slice, and you're like, my goodness, this is like the best bread I've ever eaten in my life. It's really good. Can I have the recipe? And they look at you and go, so you really love this bread. It's really tasty. Well, here you go. Here's 7 different recipes that you can use. And each of these 7 recipes will give you exactly that loaf of bread. It's what you can do with qualitative comparative analysis, if you're, in a sense, you can identify different combinations of factors that can lead to the same outcome, which is something that you really can't do in a regression model. So that's a technique that some of my colleagues and I have been combining with regression analyses and some of our research that we've been doing on actually studying the world's fossil fuel power plants, looking at how plant-level characteristics, you know, a lot of engineering sorts of things that are really important, kind of organizational characteristics, coupled with broader regulatory, demographic, and political economic factors might combine in some unique sort of configurations to explain why some plants are less efficient or just egregious polluters compared to others in a much more flexible way, in a more nuanced way than you could pursue those questions using just a traditional regression model.
So we're talking about factors like maybe the electricity output, when it was built, the state or county it's in, the type of fuel that it uses, sort of thing.
Exactly. Those kinds of factors. Exactly. And you can, and what's really interesting is from the work that we've done so far using those sorts of techniques and asking those kinds of questions, we see that in some contexts, it might be plants that are things that are perhaps obvious, big plants that are older that primarily use coal. Okay. But that also are located in places that have particular kinds of regulatory conditions that are somewhat different than over here. But over here, it might be plants with a higher capacity utilization rate that might primarily burn a different fossil fuel rather than coal, but that also tend to be old, you know, that also lead to higher emissions. We also think that this kind of approach, though, is more suitable for policy, too. You know, identifying, okay, how can we identify egregious polluters? Are there different kinds of recipes that help us identify, if we're thinking of, like, facilities, if we can call them that. I know saying egregious sounds kind of harsh, but heavily polluting facilities, rather than saying an entire sector is a problem, but what about identifying facilities that are really problematic? Is it always the same formula? Or is it possible that there could be different combinations of factors? And using something like QCA allows you to ask those kinds of questions that we think can lead to kind of more robust kinds of approaches, perhaps low-hanging fruit approaches to dealing with things like climate mitigation.
And let's bring this back briefly to people's lives. These heavily polluting plants aren't just making the air smelly, right? This is impacting people's health. People are dying earlier.
That's definitely a big deal.
And here, it reminds me of, you know, I was faculty at the University of Utah for a number of years, just down the street in Salt Lake City. And, you know, I think that everything that explains the inversion that happens, all the social and the natural factors and how they sort of intertwine, all of that, and what the unevenly distributed health impacts of that are really, in a nutshell, the kinds of things that I'm motivated to study. Like, those are really important. You know, we're talking about the health of kids and people. And I remember on some of those days during the wintertime in between storms where, you know, kids at school couldn't go out for recess, or it's like, okay, I guess I'm not going to go for a run this morning because I went outside and I can taste the air, you know, and not in a good way. But thinking about the different kinds of social factors, you know, the behavioral things, the institutional things, the structural things, the industrial things that all contribute to that in unique ways and in different sorts of combinations. And also trying to understand why the health implications associated with that aren't uniform across the entire Salt Lake Valley. And then you look at, well, okay, over in this part of the valley, this particular neighborhood might be more susceptible to particulate matter because perhaps they're closer to those refineries that we might want to talk about too, you know, and it becomes a bit of an environmental justice kind of dynamic too, you know, sure. Poorer neighborhoods that tend to be in closer proximity to more polluting facilities. It's like, okay, how did that happen? And trying to trace the history and the, which is really complicated, then it becomes, you know, like the chicken or the egg sort of thing, like what happened first? You know, those are really important questions. But it just reminds me of what you asked before about sort of problems-oriented approaches. To me, those are fundamental problems. And they're things that are largely caused by human activities, the unintended consequences of decisions that we make individually and collectively and the things that we do. And trying to understand what the implications are and how we got to this point so we can perhaps, you know, do things better. I like the idea of kids being able to go outside during recess during the wintertime.
Certainly.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're talking a little bit about trying to put more of the social processes at the center. And I recently heard a lecture from the head of, I think it's the Biosocial Complexity Center at Arizona State University. And he was talking about the need for a, quote, Copernican revolution. And his claim was that rather than coming up with sophisticated environmental models and then trying to do sort of social inputs into it, he said we need to think about it the other way around and try to put social models, which tend to be the drivers at the center, and then interface those with environmental models as appropriate. Now, I was wondering what you think about that. And I was also wondering if you see yourself and the way you do models as doing that, or if you have a different perspective.
Yeah, that's a really provocative thing. I have a feeling that he was trying to stir the pot.
Definitely was.
And I'm sure it did stir the pot a bit. Well, I guess depending on who was in the audience. I think that my initial reaction would be, I think it depends fundamentally on the question. And maybe sometimes it should be more to the center, and maybe, you know, the social should be more to the center, and sometimes it shouldn't. But what I like, though, is just broadening things and recognizing that perhaps sometimes the social should be more central and the environmental should perhaps be not so central. But I think it really depends on the question. Now, given that I'm approaching these things from a social science, environmental social science perspective, I think I tend to do that just because of how I approach my research questions and also just given, you know, what I think I'm trained and what I'm able to do, but also recognizing that sometimes that's probably not the appropriate way to do it. You know, again, I think doing good research means you need to acknowledge that sometimes that may not be the best way to pursue a question.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I've been surprised how often I found myself the only social scientist in a room of scientists talking about ecological models, and there just doesn't seem to be any talk about social models.
You see, I'm not comfortable with this idea of sort of separating them social models versus environmental models, because I feel like what I and my colleagues do is, you know, we merge social data with ecological data. And I know that how we do some of those things drives some natural scientists nuts. Like, what are you doing? You can't do that. You shouldn't be doing that. Like, yeah, but these are the limitations we have. You know, we have, and also the way that we gather social data, you know, for me, as a social scientist, like nation-state boundaries really matter because nation-states matter in terms of how we make decisions. And one of the biggest predictors of your life experience is where you live in the world, where you were born. Like, there's a lot of variation within, you know, where you're born, like within a nation. But a really big predictor of differences in life experiences is just like where you were born in the world, what nation-state you're born into. That's not the only predictor, but it's a pretty big one. And I think there really is something to that. And so, like with climate change, we're talking about something, it's a global problem, but it's caused unevenly by people and institutions that are spread out throughout the world in very complicated ways. And there are some places, there are some people and some places, some institutions and some nation states that are disproportionately responsible for a lot of the global environmental and global sustainability challenges that we're facing. And I don't think that we should ignore that. And I think that's really sort of fundamental and really important to try to understand. not to make people or places feel bad, but to identify and understand how we got here so we can try to do things better. And I also think, you know, responsibility is important, accepting responsibility for the unintended consequences of our actions or those before us. Like the United States, I mean, is a really important example of this. Cumulatively, we are disproportionately responsible for anthropogenic climate change, just what's happening within the borders of our nation, or things that decisions that we've made within the U.S. that have led to things occurring, you know, throughout the world. But, you know, that's important. That doesn't mean that we're awful human beings. It wasn't on purpose or anything like that. But it's really important, especially in terms of coming up with dealing with adaptation. You know, we're disproportionately responsible. And it's from an international perspective, that's really important. And it's not all that different from thinking of other sorts of international sort of phenomenon in terms of uneven development and human rights and those sorts of things. Because to me, these are all interconnected. Like climate change and the climate change challenge is largely tied to international and global inequities of different kinds. What's caused it and why it's been so difficult for us to really sort of in a robust way come up with and execute kind of international solutions to this. It's and some of those fundamental causes that we're really uncomfortable to really interrogate, because they're deep, they're very structural, and they're historically grounded. They're some of the same sort of fundamental things that cause some of the other challenges and problems that we have in the world.
Okay. One piece of advice that you had or wish you had going into grad school.
One piece of advice. Oh, for sure. This is something that I strongly encourage graduate students to do. Regardless of what discipline you're pursuing a graduate degree in, take as many different methods courses as you possibly can, and as many different kinds of methods as you possibly can. Because in the long run, it's just going to make you a better researcher. It's going to make you a better evaluator of research of different kinds, a better consumer of research of different kinds, a better teacher of different research of different kinds. It's just... and graduate school is like the ideal time to do that, because now I'm one of those old fuddy-duddies where I'm like, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm old. I don't have time to learn new methods, even though sometimes I try to and I need to. But when you're in graduate school, like, that's the ideal time to do it. And you're usually exposed to or provided opportunities to do that. And so my graduate students, that's one of the first things I tell any student that has expressed interest in perhaps working with, like, okay, you need to take as many methods courses as you possibly can. And also outside of your discipline, too. To think about how other disciplines use these same tools, but how they might approach using them differently. So you can have a better understanding of how they approach things. So you can also, in the long run, be better at interdisciplinary work, because this is, I mean, it's, you know, we all say it, but that this is the future, more interdisciplinary stuff. Like the Ecology Center is a perfect example of that, I think, from what I've seen so far. So...
okay. Dr. Andrew Jorgensen, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks. It's been fun. Appreciate it.